morning, everyone. Thanks very much for coming and welcome, I guess, early on a Wednesday morning. I'm Michael Green, the clerk of Green's List at the Bar. This morning is the second last of our breakfast briefing series for the CPD year. We've got another one next week about the resilient lawyer, and that also is the a non-substantive law topic. And then that's the end for this CPD year. This morning we've got Andrew Silver speaking on the duty of confidentiality, which comes under the ethics and professional responsibility heading. That point you need to gain. Of course, you're not here because of points, I appreciate. You're all here because of a great interest in the duty of confidentiality. But just in case you need the point, it's ethics and professional responsibility. A little bit about Andrew. Andrew's been admitted for 6 years, been at the bar now for the last 18 months or so. His practice is commercial, covering things like insolvency, banking and finance, property, corporations law, construction law. He appears in all of the jurisdictions. He's a nationally accredited mediator. Now, I rush through that because that's the boring part about being a lawyer, which most in the room could probably duplicate with their careers. The interesting part of it, Andrew, is if you don't get to the second last paragraph of the handout, the interesting bit is Andrew served for the Australian Defence Forces in the Middle East, Afghanistan and the Gulf of Aden, which is a bit unique. As an officer in the reserve, Andrew?
With the Navy.
In the Navy. But the reserve, not the...
No, it was a full-time posting.
Full-time posting. And so that, as I say, the legal stuff, we've all seen a lot of legal stuff over our years, but that's an interesting one. And I resonate. I've got a son who's in the Australian Defence Force and has been over there. So I resonate with that. Please, on that irrelevant note, welcome Andrew Silver. Thanks.
Thank you for that kind introduction, Michael. And thank you, everyone, for being here this early. Confidentiality applies to us as lawyers. It also applies to our clients. The duty of confidentiality can exist in a variety of ways. And it's not a particularly exciting topic, so I've tried to deal with the duty as a whole and how it applies not only to us as lawyers, but also how it applies to your clients, whether they might be bound by such a duty or whether they might have rights to enforce a duty upon somebody else. I've divided the talk up into six key questions. What is confidential information? Who has a duty of confidentiality and when? And I'll explain why it's important to differentiate between those two issues. What does that duty require? Because it's not just a duty not to disclose. I want to touch on the difference between confidentiality and legal professional privilege. I won't spend a lot of time going through the law of privilege, but it's important to recognise the difference and when you might be bound, even when privilege does not apply. I'm going to deal with when it's okay to disclose confidential information. As lawyers, we all are bound by a duty of confidentiality, but that doesn't mean that there are no times at which you can disclose that information or use it. And lastly, I'm going to talk on the remedies that are available to a client against you, or alternatively, a client against someone else, or someone else against the client, someone who wants to enforce that duty of confidentiality. The starting position, however, is confidential information. Confidentiality cannot exist unless there is information which is, at first instance, confidential. Now, it is a question of fact, and it's dealt with on a case-by-case basis. Admittedly, most of the time you're going to know if something's confidential or not. Most of the time you're not erring on the edge of whether something may or may not be confidential. But there are a couple of prerequisites for some information to be confidential information. First and foremost, there must be an element of secrecy in the information. That doesn't mean it needs to be a complete secret. It may be kept by some at the exclusion of others, but there must be an element of secrecy. The information cannot be trivial or nonsensical. and it cannot be in the public domain. And this comes back to that secrecy point. What actually is the public domain is something that comes up for discussion a bit. I naturally think of the community at large when I think of the public domain, but then I think of an analogy or an example where confidentiality may or may not apply. And the first thing that came to my mind was banking practice. It's common practice amongst the banks to have a moratorium on enforcement over the Christmas period. They tend not to take any enforcement action over Christmas. That's well known amongst the banks. It's well known amongst the banking lawyers, liquidators, but the public at large don't tend to know that. And I ask myself, well, is that confidential information? I don't think so. I think that that's in the public domain. It may not be known by the public at large, but in the community where it's relevant, it's generally known. And so it's important when someone's asking themselves whether something's in the public domain or not, to consider whether it's known by the public at large or whether it's common knowledge in an industry or in a section of the community which is not secret. Common examples of confidential information, product designs, customer lists, business plans, names of suppliers, ideas for television or radio programs, sexual conduct, personal or company finances, things that might have an element of secrecy or privacy about them. What constitutes confidential information from a lawyer's perspective goes well beyond what I first imagined. The Supreme Court decision of Youngins and Elphick provides a very handy explanation of the extent to which lawyers have confidential information. Justice Gillard provided this quote: "A solicitor makes notes, forms views and opinions of clients, and observes things that the client may have forgotten or overlooked. In some cases, the circumstances of the retainer and the nature of the legal work will be sufficient to establish the nature of the confidential information. In this regard, the relationship between solicitor and client may be such that the solicitor learns a great deal about his client, his strengths, his weaknesses, his honesty or lack thereof, his reaction to crisis, pressure or tension, his attitude to litigation and settling cases, and his tactics. These factors, which I would call the getting to know you factors. The overall opinion formed by a solicitor of his client as a result of his contact may in all the circumstances amount to confidential information that should not be disclosed or used against the client." Now this is quite critical because strictly speaking, lawyers don't have an obligation not to act against former clients. You have a duty of loyalty not to act in similar or related proceedings to those that you've been involved in. But there's nothing stopping you acting against a client 5 years down the track, so long as there isn't a clear conflict of interest. Except, of course, for this duty of confidentiality. If you have getting to know you factors, if you know things about your client, their willingness to settle, the tension, their willingness to get in the box, these are the getting to know you factors which are critical to how a client runs a case. If you do not, if you have these, you need to think seriously about whether you can act against someone for whom you've previously acted. But I would come back to the key element, and that is of secrecy. If these getting to know you factors are well publicised, if there's no secret in the getting to know you factors, well, it's not confidential information, it's not an issue. But lawyers need to be very careful of this key point. And the courts, and I'll deal with this a bit later, will restrain lawyers from acting in cases where they hold confidential information and that the likelihood of that information being relevant is sufficiently prejudicial. Who has a duty of confidentiality? I wanted to deal with this separately, and it's an important one to deal with separately. Lawyers tend not to, because lawyers automatically have a duty due to their fiduciary relationship with their client. But that doesn't mean that everyone does. Strictly speaking, the duty of confidentiality is created in contract or in equity. There are some statutory provisions which impose confidentiality. I don't propose to deal with them. Government information is protected by the Freedom of Information Act. Military secrets are protected by legislation. Personal contact details can be protected by the Privacy Act. I don't propose to go into that. What I want to talk about is that basic duty of confidentiality between individuals. Contractual confidentiality is something that we come across very regularly as solicitors. The usual laws of contract apply. Terms of settlement often include confidentiality clauses. Employment contracts or contractor contracts are the same. By far, dealing with confidentiality by way of contract is the easiest way to do it. If you have a client who has something that they want to keep confidential, put it in the contract. It's so much easier to deal with it that way. There are some contractual relationships which imply confidentiality, or it's imposed by the fiduciary duty. I've already mentioned lawyers as the obvious one. Employees also have a duty of confidentiality implied in their employment agreement. Now, a lot of experienced practitioners will think to themselves, particularly with terms of settlement, well, what good is the confidentiality clause? I can't stop them from breaching it, can't enforce it, what's the point of it? That's a valid concern, and I'm going to deal with that later under remedies, but I wanted to touch on the fact that it is an issue, and it's one that I've heard far too many times. But before I deal with that, I want to talk about confidentiality and equity. This is the more complicated part of confidentiality. There are many circumstances where confidentiality will be imposed where a contractual relationship doesn't exist. It might be that the parties intend to enter into a contract, but it's not yet formed. Or it might be that it's just not a relationship of a contractual nature. Equity imposes a duty of confidentiality upon the satisfaction of two elements. Firstly, the information must be of a confidential nature. And secondly, the information is communicated in circumstances importing an obligation of confidence. I've put up there the common test, and I'll deal with that in a second, but it's important to sit back and think about it as a matter of principle. Equity will import an obligation or a duty of confidentiality where the information is communicated in circumstances importing that obligation. It makes sense then that the test is whether a reasonable person in the position of the recipient would have recognised that the information was given to him or her in confidence. Now, I've underlined would have recognised. It's an objective test, but it is a test of conscience. The court will be interested in how the information was transferred or given over and what was imported in that transfer of information. Some circumstances, it's going to be quite clear, and there'll be an express restriction on the use of information. Don't tell anyone this, but such and such, or this is confidential, but ABC. In those circumstances, it's going to be, if the evidence proves out that that's what was said, it's going to be clear that equity will impose a duty of confidentiality. In other circumstances where it's not said expressly, the special relationship between the giver and the recipient of the information may enliven a duty of confidentiality. I've already spoken about those that have a fiduciary obligation, but those that do not, financial planners, for example, don't have a fiduciary obligation, but when you give them your financial affairs, your personal finances, in that relationship is an expectation that the information will be kept confidential. Other relationships which enliven the duty of confidentiality include prospective partners or prospective joint venturers prior to the creation of the fiduciary duties. On that, last year there was a Supreme Court decision of Vasco and Morgan Stanley, where Vasco provided a plan, a solution, a financing solution for a project that Morgan Stanley were working on. They provided it without expressly saying it was confidential. It had great value. Indeed, Morgan Stanley used it, changed it slightly, and used it to affect the financing agreement they had to come up with. Vasco sued, saying it was their information, that it was confidential information, and that someone else has benefited from it in breach of that confidentiality. And the court agreed, referred to the same test that I've referred to today, and a couple of others in relation to specific tests in relation to when confidential information is akin to property, when there's value in it. The idea is just because two people are negotiating with a common intent, so with this common idea of forming partnership or going into business, that will create an obligation of confidence between them. A mentor relationship may well create an obligation of confidence, or a lawyer bouncing ideas off another lawyer. I should say that the courts have been reluctant to reject a duty of confidentiality where information of a commercial or industrial nature is given on a business-like basis. Similar to the example I've just given, where a common object is in mind, and that's the key part, where there's a common object in mind. If I tell someone down the street, listen, I've got this great idea for a business, this is what I'm going to do, that's not the sort of relationship which would normally enliven a duty of confidentiality. But if I go to someone who I want to go into business with and say, yes, I want to do this with you, this is what I have in mind, let's come up with a plan. That relationship, the common object, that is what creates the obligation of confidentiality in equity. I should say, lastly on this point of the duty, that one cannot surreptitiously obtain information and then get around the test that they were not given the information on the requisite basis. If someone receives information dishonestly or illegally, a duty of confidentiality is going to be imposed on them regardless of what was said to them at the time of the provision of the information. This becomes particularly relevant when there's a bona fide third party, where someone surreptitiously obtains information and then hands it over to some unsuspecting and innocent person who receives it, believing it's open source information. And I'll deal with that in a minute. I want to discuss now what the duty of confidentiality requires. And I said it's not limited to inappropriate disclosure. Indeed, it's a twofold obligation, an obligation to keep the information secret and an obligation not to misuse the information. Now, there are circumstances where it's appropriate to use confidential information. And this is the key point. The obligations are not an obligation not to use, it's an obligation not to misuse. When you receive confidential information as a business partner, of course you're supposed to use it. Or if you receive them in terms of settlement, or indeed as a lawyer, when you receive your client's confidential information, you're supposed to use it. You are supposed to disclose it too in certain circumstances. But the disclosure and the use must be appropriate. It must keep the secret and it must not be inappropriate use. On the question of inappropriate use, there is an implied prohibition against using someone's confidential information to the detriment of that person. The test is whether the confidence has been abused in the sense that an unconscientious use has been made or an unfair advantage of the information has been taken. Now, one of the key issues in this regard is the springboard doctrine. A person who has received confidential information is not allowed to use it as a springboard for activities to the detriment to the party who provided that information. It effectively treats the holder of the duty of confidentiality as a fiduciary in that regard. You've got an obligation to keep it secret and not to use it for the detriment of the person who owns the information. As a lawyer, we're familiar with that. That's not a problem. But for clients, it can be a problem because one doesn't separate their mind from what they know in one business transaction and what they're dealing with in another. I've had a case recently, a stevedoring case, where one set of stevedores, our clients, are working in Geelong and Portland, and then they go into partnership in Portland separately. Now, the two businesses are not in competition. Everyone's knows that everyone's working in their respective businesses. That's fine. There's no breach of loyalty in that regard. But when the information from one business becomes relevant to the other, and that latter business can seize on that and take some sort of competitive advantage, that does create a situation of conflict of interest. And the former business is entitled to stand up and say, that's my information, you've got that through us, that's confidential information, you're not allowed to use it against us. Other examples of the springboard doctrine in effect, I'm getting a head start on a business idea is one that I've already spoken of. Publishing scandalous materials, another, and this one that comes up probably more often. When someone finds confidential information and then uses it to their advantage by selling it or publishing it, that's a clear misuse as well as an inappropriate disclosure of that information. Coming back to lawyers, a litigation lawyer who has confidential information of the other side may be restrained by the courts from continuing to act. The test that a court will apply is whether the likelihood of that information being damaging to the owner of that information, that will be weighed up against the right of parties to be able to choose their own lawyers. The courts take very seriously that participants in the legal process should be able to choose their lawyers. They should have the lawyers that they believe in. They take that very seriously, but that doesn't mean that that will override that lawyer's knowledge of the other side's information. And there are countless cases where courts have restrained solicitors and barristers from acting where the other side have information. It might be because they're a former client. It might be because 20 years ago, the solicitor knew the other side and had a personal relationship that hasn't existed for decades. But that inherent knowledge will stay with them, and the courts have been very reluctant to allow someone to act in those circumstances. I've spoken of detriment as being the key issue for unauthorised use, and I've spoken about publication. Detriment has a very wide meaning in this sense, and it also includes loss of privacy and embarrassment. And this comes back to that issue of what can you do to enforce terms of settlement where the breach isn't of a commercial nature? Well, loss of privacy and embarrassment are key detriments, and they are compensable. I might stop it there. I'll move on to privilege and confidentiality after the break.